Hello, I am Charles Webb, the Dean Emeritus of Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. Our guest today for Profiles of WFIU is Alexander Bernstein, the son of Leonard Bernstein, who is in Bloomington celebrating two things. The last performance that the School of Music, Jacobs School of Music, will give this season, and that's Leonard Bernstein's famous West Side Story. And also, we're celebrating a wonderful gift that was made by not only Alexander, but his two siblings, Nina and Jamie, to the Jacobs School of his Fairfield, Connecticut office that included a composing desk, much memorabilia, and also a gift to Leonard Bernstein from the Vienna Philharmonic of a chair that was occupied and owned by Johannes Brahms. So we are indeed very grateful for this. We're very thankful that Alexander is in Bloomington, and it is a pleasure to welcome you to Profiles.
Thank you so much, Charlie. I'm so happy to be here.
We started our association with Leonard Bernstein when Alexander was 15 years old. And I won't tell you how old he is today, but that was quite some time ago.
Oh, that's okay.
And I'm going to begin my questions, Alexander, if it's okay with you, to ask you something that probably you have been asked many times, but for our radio audience, I think will be very interesting. And that is, what was it like to grow up in a household where even when you were born, your father was famous and became even more famous by the year as you grew up? What was it like? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. It was, at the time, it was all I knew, of course.
Yes.
So I had nothing to compare it with.
Of course.
It was a joy, really. He loved being famous. Yeah. He loved being recognized.
Yeah.
Fame, I think, in those days wasn't so much an industry as it sometimes is today. And he enjoyed it. And there was just so much life in the household.
Yes, of course.
There were always wonderful and interesting people coming by.
Right.
He loved, I mean, there was the family, of course, and his siblings, who were around a lot.
Right.
But there were also all the showbiz people
who
were around and that he was very close with.
Sometimes when you talk to people who grow up in famous households, sometimes children feel a little neglected, or maybe that they didn't have enough time to be with either parent. Can you comment on that, or did you ever have those feelings?
The only time I had those feelings was when he would go on tour with the New York Philharmonic, or if he was off conducting somewhere. And he'd be gone, you know, for a month or two. But when he was home, he was really home. It wasn't as though he had an office to go to every day, especially if he was composing. So we got to see him a lot, and he loved being with his family.
Yes.
And he spent a lot of time with us, and we played a lot of word games and
of course
and
he played word games with everybody
yeah.
That's right.
And played a lot of tennis, and he, you know, he's just a regular dad in that mm-hmm. department. I never felt, you know, we knew we were sharing him with the world, basically.
Right.
And I don't think it was a decision he made that, oh, I really ought to spend some quality time with my children.
No.
He really loved hanging out with us and we with him. And he would, surprisingly, he didn't mind if I just wandered into his studio when he was working and just play with his various, the stuff he had in
there, or start
reading a book or whatever. So that was just wonderful, just to be able to hang out with him that way.
Right. It's great to hear that because, as I said, sometimes people don't have that kind of relationship. And, of course, I can say that from the outside, being with him as often as we were, I saw him be that way almost with everybody. That is, I saw him willing to stand in a line of people who came after a concert he would greet the very last person. No matter whether he was supposed to be at a dinner or a reception or what, he was happy to see the very last person. And this was a remarkable trait for somebody where people were clawing to get just an inch here and there.
Absolutely. And, you know, for us, sometimes it was tried our patience, yes, as I'm sure it did yours, when we would travel with him. And I remember going on a tour, we were in Japan, and every night it was 2 hours at least,
yes,
of signing autographs and talking to people,
right,
and you know, you just got resigned to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, another great thing about your father was his interest in education, and education for the masses as well as for the most talented musicians that would seek him out for knowledge. And I wonder if you would talk just a moment about the Center for Learning, the Leonard Bernstein Center for Learning, that you have personally been so associated,
sure,
with.
Sure. I think he was an educator pretty much in everything he did. And I think the idea of sharing what he knew and communicating really is the connecting thread of his whole life's work, whether he was composing or conducting. And he loved to teach, and he loved young people, and you know, he did the young people's concerts on television and the omnibus programs,
right,
older people's concerts,
right,
the Norton lectures at Harvard,
right,
and he was a true scholar, a wonderful teacher, and engaging and really good at it. Towards the end of his life, he really started paying more and more attention to teaching not just music, but how all learning,
right,
can be connected through the arts. Shortly, and I at the time was getting my master's in education, thinking along the same,
right,
lines. After he died, we started the Leonard Bernstein Center for Learning and developed what we call the Artful Learning Model, which is now being used in schools all over the country and will be next, very soon here in Bloomington at the Fairview,
right,
Elementary School.
Right.
And it puts the arts and the artistic process at the center of the curriculum. And we work with teachers through professional development. They learn how to work around a work of art, connecting that work of art, mm-hmm, to all the different subjects, experiencing the work of art, creating inquiry into the work, reflecting upon all that, and then the kids make something in response to it. Mm-hmm. So they really own it, they understand it, and they can talk about it. You can talk to a third grader about anything that they're learning, and they can connect it to any other thing they're learning and explain it to you, and there's a depth of understanding that goes so far beyond, you know, what's tested and, you know, the content that is
right,
determined by the state or whatever. And all of that is taught and learned, but deeply and well-remembered and owned by the children.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful model. It works splendidly.
Well, you, while you've been in Bloomington, you had an opportunity to visit the Fairview School, where the Jacobs School of Music has a very important project going on right now, as a matter of fact.
Yes, I watched this fantastic violin class.
Yes.
The Jacobs School has an amazing project of violin classes for the entire first and second grades, and it's brilliantly presented and brilliantly thought out, and they're doing research along with the instruction, so they really get to find out how it's working, how the kids are reacting to it as far as their reading scores are concerned, and all of that. And they're really learning to play the violin as well.
Right,
it's
right,
just magnificent to see.
Well, it seems that this would fit the model that you were talking about in terms of artful learning and your father's idea that to study music is not just for studying music alone, but these techniques can apply to many different areas as well.
Absolutely, and he said once that to really learn something, you have to look at it from the viewpoint of a different discipline. And I think that's really a good way of looking at all education and what's going on at Fairview and what will be in the future with Artful Learning.
Right. Well, that must also have been one of the reasons he loved puzzles so much, and to discuss all kinds of ideas with whoever he happened to be talking about, and not one-sided with music.
Oh, absolutely not. He was interested in so many things. And, you know, we would talk about it endlessly, and I'm sure you did when he was with you. Poetry, philosophy, physics, you name it, politics. He had an amazing mind and an incredible memory. I mean, apart from all the music he knew,
right,
he could recite poems, really lengthy poems, and chapters from Alice in Wonderland he could recite. It was
right.
Incredible. An amazing mind he had.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit about your siblings. And they're, unfortunately, not here with us today.
No, I wish they could be here.
I know. But tell a little bit about what they are doing.
Okay. I have two siblings, two sisters, one older, one younger.
Right.
The boy in the middle. My older sister, Jamie, works. She writes her own children's concerts, as it were, and performs them all over the world. And she narrates them.
Mm-hmm.
She's written about my father's music, but also about Copland's music, about various other aspects of music. And she's a terrific and enthusiastic presenter.
Yes.
I'm very proud of her work, and she's doing very well at that. She has a bunch of other projects as well. She never stops, and she travels a lot. And she has two kids herself. And my younger sister, Nina, is now working at a place called the Sylvia Center in New York. They teach kids about what they're eating and where it comes from.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
How important it is to know, you know, what you're eating and, mm-hmm. and what's involved in the preparation of it and where it comes from. And and it's a fantastic project, really. And she started out as a volunteer a couple of years ago, and now she's pretty much running the joint, which is
terrific.
Very exciting. And she's working so hard and doing really the Lord's work. It's fantastic.
That's great. Well, now, during this interview, one of the things that we hope is that you will tell us two or three of your favorite pieces that mm-hmm. your father wrote, and then we're going to have some music in just a moment. So why don't you mention one of those, and then we'll be able to hear it.
All right. Well, why don't we start with one that has something to do with you?
Okay.
because you were so kind to my father, you and Kent, of course, when he was here and for so many years of knowing him. And he wrote a song as part of his song cycle, Arias and Barcaroles, called Mr. and Mrs. Webb Say Goodnight.
That is right.
It's a wonderful song, a joy to listen to, and your sons also are involved.
They are involved, that's right. They're in it,
too. If you want to talk about it a little bit.
No, well, I'm happy just to say we were honored beyond belief to receive this manuscript in the mail one day without any warning whatsoever. And it certainly is a beautiful song, and I think that's what we'll listen to now. Mr. and Mrs. Webb Say Goodnight, from Arias and Barcaroles by Leonard Bernstein.
Do me, 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 do me is us.
It is us. Busy because with it is it the way that it
grows.
Fever.
One more time.
New way.
Welcome to our radio audience, back to the lobby of the Musical Arts Center of Indiana University Jacobs School of Music, where we have the great pleasure of interviewing Alexander Bernstein, the son of Leonard Bernstein, who is here for two important reasons. He is has the opportunity to hear West Side Story, which is currently being produced, and also in connection with a wonderful gift that the Bernstein family has made to Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. Alexander, I wonder if we could talk in this segment for a few moments about the influences on your father, especially I'm thinking of musical influences, but others as well, as he was both growing up and after he became who he was, Leonard Bernstein, but all musicians, regardless of who they are obviously influenced in their formative years. And I think it would be interesting to maybe hear a little bit from you about what he might have said at home or on tour, whenever you would be with him, about influences that were important in his life.
Absolutely. I think probably the two earliest influences on him musically were the music he heard at synagogue. His father was a very religious Jewish man in Massachusetts, and the cantor at the synagogue was, as I understand it, a terrific singer, and they also had an organ, and so that was a great influence on him throughout his life. He wrote a great deal of religious music. Also, just music on the radio, jazz and pop music from the time he was born in 1918. And so from, you know, in the 20s and 30s, you know, there was the jazz age and Gershwin and even the theme songs to the radio dramas and things like that and commercials. So I think that was really the first stuff he listened to. Then, of course, when he started playing the piano,
yes,
which he learned in about 2 weeks, I think, and he just started buying sheet music whenever he could and just ate up all the music he possibly could. When he started composing, I think, the influences were abundant. Later, I imagine, you can see so much Stravinsky in his work, Mahler, obviously, Puccini.
Yes.
There's a lot of that. And Hindemith, I think, he was very much taken with. And, sometimes, you hear a few bars of Brahms in some of his work. But, every composer steals from
exactly.
the former, from,
That's
from
right.
their influences. And the trick is to make it your own.
So in your household, then, did you have music on, that is, as either background or listening a lot?
Interestingly, my father couldn't stand having music on in the background.
I understand that very well.
He, if there was music, he was going to listen to it.
Exactly.
And so we rarely had music playing, and he couldn't get over the fact that my sister and I would do our homework with the radio on. He said, "How could you possibly do that?"
Yes.
So we did. We played his music, and he would listen to his test pressings of his recordings and
right.
this and that. And when we were driving in a car, we'd turn on the radio and hear sort of top 40. He always wanted to be up on what the latest rock performances were, and the latest Beatles songs or Rolling Stones, whatever. And so he loved listening to that. But just having it on in the background, not so much.
No.
But just one point about listening to that to rock stations on the radio.
Yes.
He would hear a song for the first time, and we would get to wherever we were going, if we were going to our house in Connecticut from New York, he'd sit down at the piano and play the whole song. He could remember the entire song, including most of the lyrics as well.
Well,
it was just miraculous.
I can believe that very easily, because during the time that he was in Bloomington writing A Quiet Place, where, as you know, he and his librettist, Stephen Wadsworth, were here, along with his cook and his driver and a number of other people. But we had the most wonderful experience, because he would write at night and bring the music the next day for students to perform for him, and he would have a dialogue with them about the composition itself. And we had never heard of people composing that way. Mm. And one day, he brought in an aria that he had written for a soprano and asked the girl, do you know the music of Puccini? And she said, well, yes, I know some. Well, do you know Mimi's first aria? No, I don't know that. Well, now, this aria in my opera has a kinship here. I want to show you. So he went to the piano, and he started playing the entrance of Mimi in the opera, and lo and behold, he forgot all about his opera. He was playing every part. There was no score. He was playing every part for 10 minutes. This went on. The people, the faculty and the students were aghast at this, that all of a sudden, you know, out of the blue comes this thought, and immediately he's playing the whole opera score. Right. We didn't see that so often.
But yes, he could do that. It was amazing.
Were you with him very much when he was guest conducting other orchestras, not just the New York Philharmonic, but as you know, he was sought after by every orchestra.
Absolutely.
And did you do much traveling with
him? I was so lucky that I got my sisters and me as well, got to travel with him a lot. Mm-hmm. He loved having us with him, and it was the greatest experience you could possibly imagine. You know, we learned so much about the world. We got to travel to all these wonderful places and stay at really nice hotels, you know, and eat well and meet really interesting people and see the world. And of course he had certain orchestras that he just loved to work with. Vienna,
right?
The Israel Philharmonic,
right?
Concertgebouw, he loved playing with them.
The Boston Symphony.
Boston Symphony, yeah. Absolutely. But, I mean, whoever, and of course, student orchestras. He was so fond of you know, we were talking about him being a teacher earlier, and when he was at Tanglewood, for instance,
right,
working with the student orchestra, he was in absolute heaven. And he could get them to play so much beyond themselves. It was
exactly.
Just
well,
amazing.
We had that experience in Bloomington.
I'm sure, in Bloomington.
Although he came here for those two wonderful months to work on his opera, as you well know, it was impossible for him to be isolated. Yeah. He was with students, he was with faculty, and it was an amazing thing.
Till all hours of the morning.
But when he would pick up a baton and begin to conduct one of our orchestras, it was a transformation, and it was it showed how important the conductor really is.
And the conductor as teacher. He started festivals that based on the Tanglewood model in Germany, Schleswig-Holstein, mm-hmm. as well as the Pacific Music Festival in Japan. So there's that part of his legacy is continuing there.
Well, as far as his opportunities with student orchestras, we were very fortunate in Bloomington when the Bastille Opera House could not open with an opera on the famous day that it was supposed to. And the story is that the president of France, who has much more to do with culture in that country than a president of the United States would have. But he asked for your father's advice, and your father suggested opening the Bastille Opera with five concerts by five great student orchestras. Well, of course, the next question was, what are those five? And lo and behold, one of them that he mentioned was the Indiana University School of Music.
Doubt.
And so we had a fabulous week in Paris of playing for that. So
I remember as well when the production of Mass, of my father's Mass, came to Tanglewood.
Yes.
And it was just an amazing production, truly extraordinary. I remember he was so moved by that.
Well, yes, and we even have on a television where it was being televised there by Tanglewood, we have his remarks about that performance, and it was very touching to hear him mm-hmm. speak after it was over.
So I think he said it may have been the best performance of anything.
Yes, that he said not just of Mass, but of anything. And we were flabbergasted. That was a great way. Well, now look, we are also interested in your favorites of his music, and why don't you name another thing that we could listen to here in this broadcast?
Okay. Well, we were talking about his having listened to the music of the synagogue earlier.
Right,
and
right.
He later, he wrote something called Chichester Songs.
Oh, my, yes.
And it uses the Hebrew text from the Old Testament.
Right.
But was written for the Chichester Cathedral in England. So it's an interesting
great
connection.
Well, we'll have an opportunity to hear at least a portion of Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
Welcome back to the Musical Arts Center at Indiana University, where we have the great privilege of speaking with Alexander Bernstein, the son of Leonard Bernstein, who is in Bloomington visiting the School of Music not only to hear some performances of his father's famous West Side Story, but also in connection with a gift that he and his sisters have made to the school of the contents of his Fairfield, Connecticut teaching and working studio. Alex, it's a great pleasure to have you here, and one of the things that we might talk about during this segment is the fact that your father was one of the first musicians, composers, who combined classical music and jazz music or popular music in a way that integrated both forms in a very important way. And you, of course, he, as you have said earlier, he was influenced by Gershwin. He was influenced by people in the synagogue as he was growing up. And he had a lot of musical influences. But this tension, let's say, between these two things was an important part of his life. And some people have talked about it with positive influence, some not so positive. What would you maybe comment a little bit about that particular subject?
Yeah. He was so deeply American in the sense that there was so much of the world that the European tradition that he was trained in, but also he had grown up with jazz,
right,
and also the religious music, as we talked about before. And it was this unique quality of his to be able to make all of that together his own and his own sound in a wonderful, unique way. I think since we're here listening to West Side Story this weekend, his collaboration with Jerome Robbins, I think, is really extraordinary, because both of them were trained in an absolute classically European way, and thoroughly, rigorously, and they worked so hard at it. And, you know, my father at the Curtis Institute, and throughout, you know, learning the repertoire as a conductor and also early composer, mm-hmm. Jerry Robbins, you know, learning classical ballet, but also them being so basically American. And they saw this in each other, you know, and the result in West Side Story is really remarkable in that collaboration, which they also comes out in the ballet Fancy Free, which they had worked
exactly.
on many years
exactly.
earlier. And Jerry also choreographed on the Town as well.
I think it's very interesting that during his compositional life, really, his whole life, that although many musical influences in so-called classical music, especially in the middle part of the 20th century, went deeply away from tonal music,
indeed.
Or even from what we think of as melody, Leonard Bernstein never forsook melody. He never forsook writing music that was accessible to many people. And this was both a positive and a negative thing in terms of the attitudes of certain people during those very, I would say, tumultuous times of composition.
Absolutely. Particularly in academia, I think.
Yes.
He often was very frustrated yeah. that his music wasn't, quote-unquote, taken seriously mm-hmm. because it was still so tonal, and perhaps everybody thought it was too popular
yes.
and, you know, it was all this Broadway pizzazz
yes.
and not serious enough. And he did write a lot of 12-tone music and put it in this 12-tone Rose and Cool
yes,
from
yes,
West Side
yes,
Story.
Yes, that's right. That's
but
right.
he always managed to make it accessible,
exactly.
as you say, and interesting and fun, I think, is a word that he always loved to use. Serious fun was so important to him in everything, and he saw a lot of the 12-tone music as really not yeah. fun.
Well, we have spoken often in our school here about the fact that if only he could be alive today and see, in a sense, a whole metamorphosis of attitudes about the music of Leonard Bernstein, because mm-hmm. it is played now by every major orchestra everywhere. And I think he would be gratified to read some of the critics, what critics are saying nowadays about his music, that where they weren't so kind at times in the past.
That's so true. It's wonderful and gratifying to
I'm
see
sure.
that he's performed much more now than he was when during
yes.
his lifetime, and his more serious works, you know, his symphonies, and it's fantastic. to see that.
Well, speaking of the West Side Story, I understand that you have had a very personal connection with this piece well. So why don't you just mention what you and your siblings have done in connection with live performance and also the recording?
Yes. Well, I did have the opportunity to be conducted by my father at one time when he was making a recording of West Side Story with Kiri Takanawa and Jose Carreras. It's a fantastic recording. The band is all the best players in New York.
Yeah.
And he'd always wanted to conduct it himself because he'd never conducted it on Broadway. So he did it the way he wanted to do it. So for the speaking roles of Tony and Maria, he thought it would be fun for my sister Nina and I, both of whom we were acting at the time. We would do the speaking parts when they meet at the dance at the gym. You're not thinking I'm someone else, you know. And also during the balcony scene. So there we were in the recording studio, and I'd never really figured, you know, thought of how he would cue us, you know. And suddenly he raised his eyebrow.
And I that was
know,
your cue.
And that was my cue. And I totally missed it. I was waiting. I thought he'd look at me and, you know, wave his baton or something.
Give you a big preparation.
Exactly. So we had to stop, and he said, "Alexander, that was a cue." But it was a lot of fun to be part of that. And Nina and I still have a great time joking about it. And we can't sit through a production of West Side Story without, you know, shrinking in our seats a little bit when that part comes along.
When you were thinking about when it was time to come in.
Yes, right.
Well, I can remember sitting through a wonderful concert that he conducted with the Chicago Symphony. And after it was over, he was his usual gregarious self, greeting all of the people. And I saw a person that I recognized as playing in the second violin section, just standing over at the edge of the stage, sort of by himself. And I saw all these other musicians crowding around your father, asking, "When are you going to come back and conduct us?" So I just casually said to the man, I didn't even know him, "Look at all these musicians crowding around this conductor." And normally, musicians in the best orchestras are not necessarily conductor lovers. And I said, "What do you think it is about Leonard Bernstein?" And without hesitating, this man said to me, "I can tell you exactly. When Leonard Bernstein conducts the Chicago Symphony, I feel as if he's only conducting for me." Uh-huh. And what a statement for an individual, if that had been the concertmaster maybe, or the principal oboe or something. This was somebody sitting in the second violin section, and he could say that statement. So the power of the communication, you were asking, or we were speaking a moment ago about the importance of a conductor. Well, it showed me how urgent that was, and what an influence he had on these very important and sometimes jaded orchestral players.
And I often think about how important the rehearsal process was for him, so that because by the time of the performance, often he could pretty much, you know, he had this trick, as it were, of just standing there, letting the orchestra play, you know.
Just by the Tchaikovsky, they seem to be doing well enough.
Exactly.
So he wasn't needed at that moment.
But his preparation was so rigorous.
Exact.
It was amazing.
So
amazing. And he worked so hard preparing and working on the score beforehand, marking it. And I think the orchestras really saw that in rehearsal, how well prepared he was and how he used his time very wisely. He talked a lot.
Right.
And I think a lot of musicians sometimes, you know, didn't love that. But he wanted to get his point across. And I think it was very appreciated.
Well, tell us, Alex, as you think back now over a lifetime, and at least you were lucky enough to really grow up with him before he died. Is there any incident or maybe a couple with him that stand out in your mind that you'd like to share with us and with our radio audience? Just some experience you had with him that was particularly meaningful or even humorous or whatever, just a very human side of him.
Well, I'd say just when I was lucky enough just to be with him, mm-hmm. and we would go off maybe on a ski trip together.
Oh, yeah.
To Vermont. And
was he a skier?
He loved to ski and was very enthusiastic about it and was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And we would just laugh, and he'd teach me so many things in our car rides, you know, all the way to Vermont, chairlift and so on, and falling down on the slopes and laughing about it. And also traveling with him when I mentioned before about this tour to Japan, we also went to Australia and New Zealand.
Mm.
And so I got to spend a lot of time with him and the New York Philharmonic, but he and I spent a lot of time together.
Good.
There was a time, I'll quickly tell you, during my adolescence when I was a teenager, where we didn't speak much. I was rebelling and doing all, you know, things that one does.
Yes.
15 and 16. At one day, we were sitting in the library and the radio was on, and the Pastoral Symphony came on, and I started singing along. And I it was one of my favorite things. And he had no idea that I'd been listening to classical music all this time. And he couldn't get over it, that I knew this. And so we sang the whole thing together for the next 40 minutes. And we just got back together from then on.
Well, that's a great story. And it speaks well for both of you that you got over the rough spots.
Through music.
Yes, yes, yes. Just before we finish, Alex, could you say just a word about your mother's influence on you? And I think our audience will know that she didn't live as long as your father did, but still in all, he speaks so warmly of her.
Oh, my goodness, yes. She was from Chile,
yes,
originally. She was an actress who performed a lot in New York, and she had left Chile claiming that she was going to be a pianist, which was the only way her parents would let her come to New York. God forbid she should be an actress in New York.
Yeah.
She was an extraordinary woman of grace and smarts and humor. And she was a very important influence on my father, telling him when he had gone too far, and you know, she told him what to wear because his fashion sense was impossible. So she was a very important controlling influence on him, and a lot of fun as well.
Good. Well, it has been such a pleasure, Alex, to have you in Bloomington, to have you in the Musical Arts Center, and we thank you for this interview and for sharing some of the wonderful stories about your famous and great father.
Oh, it's been a joy for me to thank you so much, and thank you for all you've done for our family and through the years, and my father appreciated you and loved you. And
well,
it
was
so
certainly
much.
Mutual. It was certainly mutual. And as we complete now, what about that third piece that you'd like to hear?
How about, since we've been listening to West Side Story and talking about it, I think my favorite song is Cool.
Cool.
West Side Story. The fugue really sends me.
We'll find that and we'll all listen to it together.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2010. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.